So please help me give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Chris from the Oceanfront Men's Meeting. Homecoming.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
My name's Chris, and I am an alcoholic.
Chris.
And that's one of the most powerful declarations that I can make, because it expresses a couple of things. One, it expresses the truth. It's, I am an alcoholic. And I'm very, very grateful to be sober. I love being sober. And appreciate the opportunity to speak here. This group has a great vibe. Been here a couple of times. My thoughts are generally like a drunken monkey swinging from limb to limb. So, I brought something to kind of keep me on track. My sobriety date is November 1st, 1993. So, that's a little bit of a while ago. This book is almost 32 years old. It has survived all sorts of things, including at least two labs eating and gnawing the corners. The cover is gone. But in my first meeting, somebody came up to me and kind of grabbed me and bought me a big book and bought me a 12 and 12. And I've had them ever since. And I was very grateful for that. When I say I'm an alcoholic, it's an admission and it's an acknowledgement. And it's almost like saying open sesame. Because as soon as I acknowledge that I am an alcoholic and my way ain't working, all of a sudden a new life can open up. I mean, the possibility is there for me. So that's why I say it's such a powerful statement for me. I got a late start. I made up for it, but I got a late start drinking. Have two older brothers, neither of whom seem to have a problem. They definitely have a taste for alcohol, but they didn't wind up like I did. And early childhood was full of fear, uncertainty, and they put the fun in dysfunction. And that laid the groundwork for my drinking. Because when your world is kind of uncertain and it's, you're always full of fear, you're always guessing at what normal is, I mean, I say, come on, let's get it on, And that really, really primed me for the effects of alcohol, because alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And we would learn in the text that it gives us that sense of ease and comfort, and man, we just chase that thing hard. So I had my first drink, I think sitting on my dad's lap. I was probably 5 or 6 years old, and he poured a little beer in this little tin cup, and I could still taste it. I can still smell it. I won't obsess over it right now. But it's as real to me as it was way back then. That's the first clue. And then sixth grade, took a can of Pepsi, wrapped it in some white paper and labeled it beer. And I took a beer and labeled that Pepsi and brought them to school. And, I had a blast. And so people were like, oh, you brought beer to school, let me have some. Oh, that's Pepsi. I'm like, yeah. And I'm sitting over here drinking the Pepsi, which is actually a beer. And only one or two of my friends kind of keyed in on that. We're like, hey, let me have a little bit. So that was the extent of it early on, but it was always in the house. Unfortunately, I helped my dad take his last drink. He drank himself to death. It was pretty ugly. So I always remember that this is a deadly disease, and I do have to respect it. I can't take it lightly, and I don't want that. I don't want that for my family. I don't want that for me. But it's very, very real. Growing up, you know, typical childhood, played a little bit of sports, wasn't good at it. In high school, always felt like I was on the outside looking in. Always had that, I always watched people, like, man, how did they do that? They always seemed to have, like, they got their stuff together. I was always kind of puzzled by that. And then, I guess by senior year of high school, I always had a backpack on. And I always kind of flew just below the radar. And I was involved in, you know, photography and whatnot. And I wasn't on the yearbook committee. I wasn't on any of these things. But I always had my camera. And people thought that I was on the yearbook committee. And so one day I'm sitting there with my backpack. And a buddy of mine was sitting next to me at the lockers. And he pops his grape soda. I'm like, damn, there's quite a head on that grape soda there. He goes, yeah, you want one? I'm like, sure. So he reaches in his locker, pulls out a beer. And he also had a big old roll of Reynolds Wrap. So he wrapped the beer in the Reynolds Wrap, and we sat there, and we used to have a beer with lunch. And the administrators would walk by, hey, how's it going? Yep, oh, good, good. I always got away with stuff. And, you know, again, that was the extent of it. I didn't get into it too much. And then went to college. It was local. Went to George Mason for 2 years. And on my 21st birthday, my older brother decided he was going to get me drunk. And he did. Well, he didn't. He put me in a position where I did. And I got absolutely hammered. It was the first time I ever really, really got hammered. And wound up, I had a paper route at the time. And I was just, I don't know if I actually went to sleep or what, but I was in my Dodge Omni, styling, and driving around, and I was really, really puzzled, and I'm going probably about 4 or 5 miles an hour, and I couldn't figure out why this light post kept coming at me. I'm like, that's so weird. And all of a sudden, I hit the curb, and I'm like, oh, and I, you know, went on. That was the drunkest I'd ever been. And that was the first of many others. My daughter doesn't drink. When she has friends over, they'll play games, they'll do all these other activities, and they never drink. That was such, I was absolutely floored. I couldn't, that's like, what's going on? I was very grateful for it. But my childhood wasn't like that. When I went out to, you know, socialize, it was to get hammered, absolutely hammered. I didn't know any different. I didn't know you could not do that. And so I began to drink more and more, and signs began to occur. I had a girlfriend once that said, man, you drink just like your dad. And that pissed me off. I do not. And how dare you say that to me, and, you know, whatever. Being a good, oversensitive alcoholic. And then got into the workforce. I bounced around. I had so many different jobs growing up, and drinking was always part of it. I was drinking with some friends, and they said, oh, do a magic trick for the owner. So the owner came over, and I did this magic trick for him. He goes, oh, wow, that's great. You want a job? I'm like, yeah, sure. So I had a job for, I don't know, a year or so doing magic behind the bar at this thing. Of course, it was all you could drink, which is, you know, that was awesome. And then I never could seem to hold on to any one job for very long. I was always kind of bouncing around here and there. Finally wound up teaching. And by that time, I was really, really, really raw. I had no idea why, but inside, emotionally, just totally raw. And so I found out that margaritas on back to school night kind of was a great idea, because I could sit and I could talk, and, you know, I became much more fluent in, you know, the kids' native language, at least I thought I was. And drinking became more and more a part of how I coped with feeling ill at ease. You know, they say, we have a disease. It is dis-ease. I am not at ease. And so I'm a feel-good addict. I want to feel good. And so what do? I chase whatever's going to make me feel good. If I'm feeling good, I want to feel better. If I'm feeling great, I want to feel even greater. And I'm feeling bad, I want to feel good. And I knew how to get it. But it was the common theme where alcohol helped me cope with life. I had no other skills. And eventually it started biting me. I got arrested just outside. I was on 66, leaving a bar. And I got pulled over, and I'm thinking, that's a Dulles Airport cop. I think he's out of bounds. And sure enough, when the court case came, my lawyer was asking me all these questions. I said, yeah, I think he's out of bounds. And then they had me, I had to do blood work. And they said, we need to send your blood work to get it verified. Where do you want to send it? And I scanned the list, and I'm like, El Paso, Texas? Yeah, I wanted to go there. That was the furthest place away. So they sent it off, and when the results came back, whoever the clerk was that filled it out didn't have great handwriting. They could not legibly read one of the letters in my name, and there's only four. And they screwed it up, and so that was inadmissible. And then my lawyer got me off saying, okay, the cop was out of bounds, that's inadmissible, and when you were giving him his sobriety test, and you say you asked him to do the alphabet, and he couldn't, was it possible he was asking for a clarification, like L or M? And the cop said, well, yeah, okay, no further. Thanks, Judge. Boom, I was out. So I got off that. And I swore, I mean, my gut was just tied in knots for weeks and weeks and weeks ahead of that because I was looking at $5,000-$10,000 in fines. I had no money. I was a teacher, inner city DC, and just, I had nothing. And that would have been really bad. And I swore, I'm never drinking again. I am never, ever, ever going to be in this position. Less than 2 months later, I was hammered. I was sitting at a bar in Ocean City, and I looked over, and somebody had a drink. I said, oh, what's that? And they said, whatever it was. I said, oh, huh. And they said, you want a sip? I said, oh, yeah, sure. And then they happened to look that way, and I drained that sucker. I mean, like two, it was gone. And then I was gone because I said, all right, well, that felt pretty good. Let's start drinking again. And I tried to quit drinking a couple of times. I just couldn't stay stopped. And then I had a moment. I had a classroom full of kids. And I was like, wow, I think I'm going to start bawling my head off. And I have no idea why. I don't think this is very good. And so I said, kids, sit down, read this page, I'll be right back. And I don't know why, but I was friends with the school counselor, and she was just down the hall. So I sat down, and I said, I don't feel good. What's the matter? I said, I don't know, I don't feel good. She goes, oh, okay. And then she gets on the phone, I find myself over at the EAP, Employee Assistance Program, that afternoon, and we have a very short conversation, and part of the conversation went, you know, is anybody in your family drinking? I said, oh yeah, my dad drinks, you know, at least a six pack a night. I mean, probably two, three. Huh, well, how much do you drink? I said, well, I don't drink that much. Really? I'm like, yeah. So she said, well, how would you like to lose the fear of economic insecurity? And I said, you can do that? How'd you like to be free? And know the word peace and serenity. And all of a sudden, she starts reading me the promises, just asking me these questions. And I about throttled her because that's what I wanted. I had no idea why she was saying those things to me, but that's what I wanted. And she said, would you agree that you have more reasons not to drink than to drink? Yeah, whatever. She goes, okay, why don't you go to a meeting? So I go, all right. So I go to this meeting, and it was a Friday. And then I had to see her on Monday. And I'm sitting there with her. So she said, so did you drink over the weekend? Yeah, why? Well, I thought you said you weren't going to drink. I said, I don't think we talked about that. That's why you went to a meeting. I'm like, oh. So I credit that. Monday was my first real meeting. And Monday was the first meeting. But I had to see her before I went to that. That's what happened. And she just said, hey, did you drink over the weekend? I said, yeah. And that conversation happened. She just kind of shook her head and said, we'll go to the meeting tonight. So I went to the meeting, and that's when I got this. I got my other text, the big book. And that was the beginning of a new life, because I don't know why. I think it's the grace of God that some of us actually were exposed to this, and for whatever reason, some of us actually go, okay, I'm in. Not knowing any better, and thank God. What AA has done for me is it's done two things. It has exposed me to the truth, and it's exposed me to hope. And the hope is that I never have to take a drink again. And that's one heck of a bit of hope in there. And all I have to do is embrace the truth, follow the instructions. And if I do those simple things, I get to stay sober. And people around me get to benefit from not being around a jerk, let's just say. I was so emotionally bankrupt and raw. I had done things that I was ashamed of. So there was shame, there was loathing, and just incredible angst, which is a great Scrabble word. Angst, vex, vi. Anyway, I don't know how to even play some Scrabble. Did I tell you I'm distractible? Anyway. In pursuing that, my first 6 months, I just went to meetings. I was kind of spooked by it because they had this triangle thing and there was a circle and people were hugging each other. And I'm like, ooh, yeah, I don't know about that. But I found a small group of people. We used to hang out in Georgetown, and they kind of took one look at me and said, yeah, why don't you hang with us? And so there's the fellowship. The fellowship has the power to support us, but the steps have the power to change us. And 6 months in, I broke down in a meeting. I have no idea why. Well, I do. I was dry. I'd stopped drinking, but that was it. And I'm sitting there, snots, you know, flying and everything. And this guy next to me goes, you all right? I'm going, oh, yeah, I'm fine. And so we go off, and he talks to me a little bit, says, yeah, dude, you really need to get a sponsor. I said, well, how do I do that? He goes, we have to ask somebody. I'm like, oh. He goes, do you want me to be your sponsor? I said, yeah, yeah. So he was my sponsor for about the next year and a half, and he was okay. He helped me through the first part, and we started working the big, his sponsor, thank God, was deeply, deeply entrenched into the big book. And so that had carried over to him. And then I started hanging out with another group of people, and they all started getting better. And their lives were improving. I could see changes in them. And I'm like, damn, I want that. But I was petrified. I always heard people talking about, we got to work the steps. You got to work the steps. I didn't know how to work the steps. I knew the phrase, but I had no idea what it meant. And I kept making excuses not to ask this guy to be my sponsor because I was I was terrified that he'd make me work the steps and actually get to work. But again, this is a program of attraction, not promotion, and I wanted it so badly that finally I said, will you be my sponsor? He goes, all right. And he said, man, this is years later, he said, your voice, when I talked to you, it was like nails on a chalkboard. I just, God, and then you asked me to be your sponsor. I'm like, okay. Gee, self-esteem, I'll take some of that. And it describes us, we are unlovely creatures. And I had an awful lot of growing up to do. That's one of the other things that AA allowed me to do. It allowed me to grow up. Not many places will ask you to come back if you're, you know, whatever. AA does. Yeah, especially you need to come back. I keep coming back. And I did. But again, that's part of the truth, because my sponsor also, and so once I got working with him, he was old school, and he taught me how to use the big book and the 12 and 12 together. He said, the big book's going to give you all your instructions. The 12 and 12 is going to further explain those instructions and provide more detail, more understanding for you. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I'd call him up and I'd be, you know, nit, 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 nit. And he'd like, okay, well, which step is that? I'm like, well, I don't know. Well, why don't you turn to page and he'd direct me. He said, go get your 12 and 12. We'd be on the phone. And I'd have to go get my 12 and 12 from my big book. And he said, read this page here. And then he'd start reading. I was like, I can read. But no, he had to read. And he would read, you know, a couple of pages. I'm like, really? Can we be done? But he taught me. And he taught me how to take this information, this instruction, and apply it in my life. And I later found out that's how you stay sober. It's easy to get sober. All you have to do is walk up and slap a cop in the face. You get sober real quick. It's the staying sober part that's the hard part. And I later found out his sponsor was Joe from Joe and Charlie. So I got to meet Joe and Charlie, and I hung out with them on numerous occasions. But thank God, because my understanding of what all this stuff was really, really skyrocketed once I got into those tapes and sitting down with those guys. You know, I talk a lot about the truth, and my sponsor told me, he said, you know, we always recognize the truth when we see it. We may not like it, but it's there. It'll set you free. It'll also stomp your ass if you go against it. And I kept seeing people around me. They kept progressing and improving and whatnot, and I desperately wanted that. Step four was a lot about accountability. He told me it was a fact-finding mission, and the object was get rid of the great big things that are blocking you off from God. You know, yeah, you can get really granular about it, but it's the great big things. What's eating your lunch today? Let's take care of that. What's going to make you drink? And so I began working on that. And that the fourth and the fifth step, I think, are two of the most powerful tools for me, because it's accountability and it's truth. It reveals what is my part in this. And then the fifth step is almost like, welcome to the human race. You really think you're that special? No. But I can't do it by myself, because I can't separate the true from the false. You can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. And I have to have somebody else's perspective. I've got to have God as part of that equation in there to help me see the truth on that. that's a treasure chest, because once I understand what's wrong with me, then I can begin working on it. If you take a vehicle to the garage and go, something's wrong with it, can you fix it? Well, what's wrong with it? Well, I don't know. Well, what do you want me to fix? Well, I don't know. I got to know what's wrong with it in order to fix it. And that's what that does. And that becomes a lifelong process. And as I get further on and I'm doing that spot check inventory, anytime I am off center, anytime I'm not feeling great, I can recognize it. And now I can say, okay, something ain't right. And my tolerance for not feeling good is a whole lot lower than it ever used to be. So I can't sit in that and stew in that for long. I've got to be able to do something. And this tells me what to do. It allows me to form a true, honest relationship with another human being and not be deceitful, not feel as if I have to put on a mask. I always had a mask on. You know, whatever group I was with, that's who I was. And, you know, it's the old chameleon thing. And there's a tremendous freedom in owning who I am, owning all my quirks, owning all my, you know, absent-mindedness and all that stuff. It's like, yeah, that's me. It's great, isn't it? Because I don't have to be anybody else. And I can be okay with that. As a result, I've got a life beyond what I ever could have imagined. I never saw that growing up. I've got an incredible marriage. I've got, that alone is priceless. I've got a great relationship with my kids. You know, they don't mind me being around most of the time. I got four dogs. They're awesome. They don't mind me. I'm comfortable inside my own skin. I have the ability to laugh at myself, and there's a lot to laugh at. There's, you know, yeah, easy now. I couldn't ask for anything more, and I've got a pathway. This was the pathway to integrity. This was my discovery of the ancient art of living life. You know, how to be a man, how to be accountable, how to have integrity and character. Those are concepts that I used to hear about, but I never knew how to get it. My sponsor also told, he's funny. I was whining to him one day and he said, "You have a closet?" I'm like, "Yeah." "You have a camera?" "Yeah." "You got any candles?" I'm like, "Yeah." He said, "Why don't you go take a picture of yourself? Get it printed out, nice 11 by 14. Set it up there in your closet and get you some candles. Light them all. And then I want you to sit there and I want you to worship that picture." I'm like, "What? You're playing God, you idiot. You're worshiping yourself." He said, "Stop playing God." That was, again, the truth set you free. I had unreasonable expectations of myself. Nobody could meet those expectations. They were so unrealistic. The only person who could do that was God. So I had to stop playing God. There was another thought on that, but that's gone. Truth will set you free. God's job is to worry. My job is to work. And he said, "You know, if you ever read the Bible, you'll discover where God, it says God worked for 6 days, then he took a break. Well, if you look real careful, I don't think you'll ever find where he went back to work. So if there's any work to be done, you have to do that." And God doesn't do windows. That's your job. You are not qualified to handle two jobs. Your job is to work. His job is to worry. Stay in your lane. And that has been very, very successful for me. This disease will make you feel apart from, not a part of. And there's a lot of alcoholics in the rooms that are apart from, because we put that mask on. And I found I have to stay in the middle of the program. I have to keep taking action. I plan on spending the first 2 hours tonight just talking about the, what? I am just so very, very grateful to have found a way of living. You know, they talk about this is an unshakable foundation for life. It works when nothing else does. And I guess I'll close with a quote from the Big Book. It's very, very concise. It's 25 words or less. And it comes at the end of the 11th step. And I think it really sums up the entire program. And it just says, it works. It really does. So anyway, thank you for listening to me. And let's eat some cake.
Thanks, Chris. That was great.
Thank you, Chris. It was great. So next up, we're going to have Steve come up and talk about Step 8, right?
Thank you, Jim. Good evening. My name is Steve Roach, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
Chris, thank you very much for coming out. We appreciate you being here and sharing you. I really like the thing about Jesus only works 6 days. Congratulations to tonight's celebrants. Before I forget, when the meeting's over, don't leave. We've got cake and pie and all kinds of crazy stuff back there.
Hi,
so,
right.
Sir? That'll be later, Mike. Just slow down. I was getting ahead of everything. So, it says, made a list of the persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all, right? So willingness is the key when I approach step 8. And in my 8-step list began, the basis of it was my 4-step inventory. The people that were on my grudge list, and some of the people, actually all, everybody, it was on my sexual relations list. Just because I didn't make amends to any of those people except for one, my ex-wife. But my sponsor told me that the women that I'd been involved with, that I had hurt them enough already. And he said, what good would it do to just rip off the scab again? You know, the wound is already healed, why rip the scab off? And so it's one of the lessons that I learned is that there's some people that can't be reached and that shouldn't reach out to. And it was, you know, people that had been, women that had been in relationships prior to getting sober, getting married. So my sponsor had me break it down into 4 categories. We opened up the notebook. So the magic notebook that appears when we do the 3rd step and get ready to write the 4th step, the magic notebook that appeared. In that, I skipped a few pages and started him, and he said, do it in 4 columns. He said, we're going to do the first column is the amends. So first I got to make the list, right, of all the people. Just make the list of the names. Kind of like the inventory. Just make the list of the names you don't have people amends to. And then those names get classified into 1 of 4 categories. The amends that I can make now, the amends that I have to wait, the amends that I can't make, and the most important column is the amends that I won't make. And I'm grateful to tell you that I don't have anybody in the 4th column that I can think of. And so I did that, right? And these are just the people that I'm willing to make amends to in the last column, the ones that I won't. And there was only 2 former coworkers of mine that made that 4th column. And the only reason they were there was because I worked on a construction crew back then, and the 3 of us, these are 2 reefer heads, man. They smoked pot every day. But we got along, right? I'm already sober at this point. I'm a couple years sober. And one day we're joking around, and nobody knew that I was in AA. Nobody knew. And I broke my anonymity to these guys. And then I became the laughing stock, and I got mad. We almost came to blows a couple times, and it was like, that was it. And the lesson I learned from that is this is why I don't break my anonymity anymore. And I know a lot of people, I know there's people that have been sober for decades and decades, and they're very open about telling everybody they're in AA. The lesson that I learned is I don't break my anonymity because it's going to cause me pain later on in my life. And so I'm very protective about that today. My wife and I were at a wedding for a friend of ours over in Norfolk, and I saw a lady from the program, and she saw me, we waved, and then she came over and was sitting down, and And I said, now listen, now these people know I'm an AA. She said, go, good, because nobody knows I'm an AA either. Well, good. So I make that clear because I want to protect that part of my life, right? My sponsor taught me that I got to compartmentalize my life. My work life and my work life, family life and my AA life, they're separate. I need to keep them separate. And so I got this list. I've got these names. And I started doing this category. And the willingness, right? And so this is the importance, I believe, of like Chris was talking about, the 12 and 12. Because in step 8 and the 12 and 12, step 7 deals specifically in talking about gaining some humility in my life. Because when I go to these people, I've got to come from a place of humility if this is going to really work for me. And if I'm going to get the results that the book talks about having. And so in step 8 and the 12 and 12, it talks about the type of harm that I've done to other people. And how, you know, because I always thought I either hurt you by beating you up or stealing from you or it was something else. You know, there's no, but so there's mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual pain and damage that it causes other people. And I didn't know this. And so I'm grateful that my sponsor had me read this stuff and we talked about it and we came up with a plan. And to me, the most important ones, we do the family ones first, right? Our immediate family, the easy ones. The financial ones came later. I had a young family. We were just starting this little construction business, so we didn't have any money. There was no money to be sending out monthly payments to because I could barely keep up with the bills that we had. So we do the family members first. My sponsor said, do your wife and your mom, your dad, and all that. Do them first because most of the time they say, oh, I'm so happy you're sober. You know, wish you well, blah, blah, blah. So we want to get a good feeling and get some momentum going. Because invariably, most of us, at least it was the case for me, I do the first few amends and then I just stop. Because I start feeling so freaking good about it. It's like, why do any more? This is great. Why should I do any more, right? And then I start losing altitude. And so invariably, I call my sponsor, man, I don't know what's wrong, blah, blah, blah. He's like, well, where are you at in your ninth step? You know, where are you at with the amends process? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So I started categorizing. I do all the ones that I can do now, which is all the immediate close family members. And the ones that have to wait, most of those were the financial ones because I just didn't have the money. And the amends that I couldn't make, as an example, when both of my grandmothers are gone now, but when my fraternal grandmother passed away, I didn't go down to the funeral. And this woman was very, very good to me as a child when I grew up down there with my family in Mexico. And she was really, really good to me. And when I was 18, 17, 18, I was back in Mexico. And she had knee surgery. And she was in her 90s, I think, by then. And my job was to take her back and forth to physical therapy. And I just freaking hated it. I was so put upon that this woman had been so good to me that I got to get her, pick her up, and take her to therapy and take her back. And, man, I turned the radio up loud. I wouldn't talk to her. And I was such a jerk to my grandmother who was so good to me. And so my sponsor and I, we talked about what the plan was. And so when I finally got to the ninth step and I'm making amends, so I got to go to her mausoleum where her remains were kept. And I got to make amends to her. And it was one of the most moving experiences I've ever had, just me and my grandmother and her ashes. It was just absolutely fantastic. And I'm glad. So that's why we have this list, and that's why we put it in these categories. So now I got to move her into the category of the amends that I could make and that I did make. And so by separating them like this, what it does, it gives me a plan of action, right? So my sponsor looked it over and said, yeah, you can do these. All right, and so when I put like all the old girlfriends and my ex-wife and all that stuff, no, you can't touch, no, don't talk to her, no, don't call her, no, straighten up. Because why bring more damage? And I'll tell you this, I know this is combining, but let me tell you this quick story about my ex-wife. So she, you know, we got married in high school, and she got pregnant, had a miscarriage, no kids, but we ended up getting divorced later on. And she reaches out to me a couple years ago, about maybe 5 years ago now, before COVID. I was driving around and just having to park in the shade somewhere because I was answering some emails or whatever. And my phone rings and she says, hey, Steve, you know who this is? I recognize her voice immediately. I ain't seen her in 35 years. And it's like, yeah, I know who this is. And she said, I'm just reaching out to you, blah, blah. And she told me this story that she apparently had some kind of accident. There's some brain trauma, and she's trying to recreate her life, and she reached out to me for some reason. I hadn't talked to her in forever, and I got to make amends to her in a very kind and gentle way, and I told her, I said, well, listen, I want you to know that I wasn't a good husband to you. I didn't treat you as well as you deserve to be treated. I was kind of mean to you. I drank a lot. And she says, I don't remember any of that. I don't remember our marriage being like that. I said, well, I kind of remember that part of it, you know, and I wish you well and blah, blah, blah. And so we became friends kind of. And then she befriended me on Facebook. And then and so I have this like an hour conversation with her, right? First person I call, as soon as I hang up, is my sponsor. Second person I call is my wife, right? Because I got no secrets. I got no skeletons in my closet today. And so I'm telling my wife the story. My daughter's like, yeah, uh-huh, where's she at now? You know, I'm like, what are you going to do? And so apparently we became friends on Facebook, but then she started sending me text messages that my wife and I both thought were in a, you know, just a little past in line with little heart and kissy emojis. And my wife said, the last one, she's like, that's it, cut it off right now. So I sent her a very well-worded, very kind and gentle response that, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't be a part of your life like this because it's not fair to my wife, so on and so forth. And so that's what you guys have taught me to do, right? Because the old me would take advantage of that situation, like, oh yeah, I'll be there next week, you know, I'll spend a weekend with you kind of deal. Because that's my nature, right? So all my old girlfriends, for example, I want to go make amends to every one of them. I want to show up with a nice suit and tie on and say, look at me now, right? Yeah. Come on, let's go and have some dinner or whatever. And so that's why it's such an important part to have my sponsor guiding me through this process. Because as well or as poor as my motives may be, I need somebody to check them for me. Because I've proven beyond a shadow of doubt, I can't be trusted with that kind of stuff. You know, when it comes to ulterior motives, I'm not your guy. Because I got plenty of them. And so by doing the steps and put them in the four categories, the four columns, then my sponsor says, all right, let's do this next. So as an example, when it got time for the financials, again, I got a young family, can barely make the mortgage and the car payment. So he says, well, you got to do something. Because it's easy. The easy answer is like, well, I ain't got the money, so I guess ain't nobody going to get paid, right? And it's fair, it's honest, it's true, but I still have to make the sacrifice. Because the reward, the benefit for me, that I'm just talking about for myself, for this alcoholic comes from the sacrifice that I have to make. Because what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to right the wrong. I'm not trying to be good. I'm not trying to get good. I'm just trying to right the wrong that I committed to other people. And so we were joking about this at dinner. At one time in the mid-80s in Virginia Beach, I was a one-man crime wave. I just was. I was telling a story. The worst thing we were doing is jumping going to the other apartment complexes and jumping in the pool until somebody chases out and then we go running right ahead. And then one night, this guy, Archie, shows up with a gun. And I said, Archie, what are you going to do with that? He said, I'm going to go rob someplace. I was like, let's go, man. There was no thought whatsoever. It just, like, immediately I said, well, let's go. I'm in. And then next thing you know, give me the gun. Let me show you how to do it. I never stole anything. Man, I was thinking of places left and right. And we lived like right across the street from the police station. It was just stupid like you wouldn't believe. But we didn't get caught. They almost caught me, but they didn't catch me. So I have a lot of societal amends that I had to make. And I'm not done. I'm sure I made most of them, but I haven't done all of them. Because there's no way I'm ever going to be done with all of it. And so one of the things my sponsor taught me to do was that I have to find a way to repay society for all that I committed. Because most of the businesses aren't even there anymore. And all the people that are robbed, it's legally called strong arm robbery. And so all the people that I robbed, I don't know who they are. I just stole money from you. I just want your money. I didn't ask you for your name and address. And so, you know, so those are the societal amends. And so the sacrifice that I made was that we agreed that I was going to go work for Habitat for Humanity on the weekends and build houses for poor people. And that's how we came to it. And my sponsor said, figure out how much you make per hour, how much is debt. We figured out a debt number, right, of all the money. And I have no idea what the number really is. But I came up with a number, and he says, all right, now double it, just to be on the safe side. So we doubled it. It was a lot of freaking money, and tens of thousands of dollars. And so that's what I did, you know. And every once in a while, something comes up when I'm reminded of some old amend that I didn't make. And this is why it's so important that we gather together outside of Alcoholics Anonymous so we can tell these stories, right? Because these are not conversations nobody in our church would ever hear any of these things. Where the church and I and my wife go through, there's no freaking way I'm telling any of those people anything that I tell you guys here. But I have to come here and I have to tell you the truth. because this is who I really am. There's most of the ladies at church think I'm just like Mr. Wonderful. Like, oh, they're talking about, your husband's so nice, you know, da 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 da. Yeah, they have no idea, right? Because they only see the finished product. They didn't see all those crazy years in the beginning. Even when I was newly sober, life was bad at home. Because I still have all this untreated alcoholism, because I didn't really get my life turned around in sobriety until I was about 3.5 years sober. And that's when I got the bill over here in Portsmouth. But prior to that, it was bad, man. I was short-tempered, I was mean, angry all the time. I think now, because I've said for decades, I don't know why I'm so angry. I'm so angry all the time, man. I mean, you know, I'm not a punch a hole in the wall kind of guy, but I'm a slam the cabinet door guy. Right? And I'd slam the freaking cabinet doors till they just pop off the hinges. So I'm really good. If anybody's got any cabinet repair at home, I'm your guy, because I had to fix them all. You know, the fork drawer, bam, slamming it so hard, the other part comes flying off. I'm that guy. And so Jake's the hole in the wall guy. Not my ticket. I was too afraid to break my hand because I know I had to go to work. And so there was a lot of struggle and a lot of strife and a lot of pain in our home still in the first few years of sobriety, because I didn't get better overnight. My life did not improve overnight. It took a long time. And unlike most of you, as an example, my spiritual awakening took place when I was about 10 years sober. Because and this is just my take on it, is that I believe that because of all the harm and all the damage that I committed for so long, I had to make a lot of amends. And my societal amends took a lot longer than most, because I didn't have the money to pay. I didn't have, you know, $10,000 to send here and $15 over there. So I was working on the weekends, spending Saturday building houses and doing other stuff for poor people for free, you know, because that's part of the sacrifice. Then that's where the sacrifice came from. And so by doing that, it allowed me to start growing. And just like Chris said, man, I grew up. I was immature, childish, selfish, all those things at home, even with a wife and two kids. And I was still acting that way. And I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous because you guys taught me how to behave. You guys taught me how to be a man here. Otherwise, I'd still be, you know, I'd probably be in my pajamas playing video games or something. I don't play video games now, but I'm sure if it came up, I probably would, you know. I could see me doing that, because I'm naturally lazy and unmotivated, and I don't like to work, so that's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you.